your laptop, your software versions might change. The libraries you use might change, but everyone's got their mobile on them. And if WhatsApp is one of your primary communication mechanisms, you're likely going to be clicking stuff and opening things out. And this one's a zero click. So watch out, folks. Watch out, especially in those parts of the world.
I watched one of the old Terminator movies the other day, and Linda Hamilton is carrying around her phone in an aluminum chip bag. And I think I might start doing that as well.
Everyone gets a portable Faraday for Christmas.
That's right.
Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast, weekly Intel chat. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. Joining me today to break down the cybersecurity news being shared by the awesome InfoSec community is the one and only Matt Bromley. And don't forget, this podcast is brought to you by Lima Charlie, maker of the SecOps Cloud Platform, infrastructure for security operations. Think of it as a backend for your MSSP, where everything is built API first. Scale with ease and confidence as your business grows. You can start today for free at limacharlie.io. Now let's get into it.
How are you doing today, Matt?
Hey, Chris, I'm doing well. How are you doing today, sir? Good to see you. Happy
good to see you too.
November, I think. No, it's our second week in November. Never mind. I won't say happy November, but great to see you in November.
Yeah, I was going to say I've been sort of flabbergasted by how much agentic AI stuff I've been seeing this week. And I don't know if it's the frequency illusion at play, because we're doing some work with that at Lima Charlie right now. But it seems to be everywhere. I'm just curious if that's your experience as well.
Well, for me, it's a daily thing, because at Profit Security, where I'm at, we're building out an agentic platform. So I get to see it every single day, which is good. But I think it's growing from an industry perspective, from a footprint perspective. What's funny, Chris, is as much as I see a growth in AI, I also see a lot of growth in doubters and detractors, I guess, if you will. A lot of folks, I think, like LinkedIn, for example, I was looking for a friend's article the other day and came across probably two posts promoting the value of AI, and then eight posts that were, you know, oh, this is not worth it. This is a waste of time. This is a giant bubble and stuff like that. So I think the world is split on where to see it, but everyone has an opinion, Chris. That's one thing I do know. You know, everyone's got an opinion on the matter, and they're happy to share and talk about it. So I guess that's where we are now. It's driving some industries in different directions, but it's also driving a very vibrant discussion as well. So
And I think part of that doubt's got to come from the fact that it's so easy for people to throw their hat in the ring now that there is a lot of garbage out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is, I think, one of the quintessential problems, but also one of the benefits from an AI perspective as well, is it's very easy for everyone to get to the same playing field, if you will. And this has been, I think, one of the best parts about AI, in my opinion, is, you know, most other forms of technology and other things that you might look, you know, you might interact with or work with, there's been sliding scales of expert level insight and capabilities. And what I mean by that is, like, if you take like a basic programming language, right? And Chris, I've often held this belief that like every single thing that's ever been created from a software perspective could easily be recreated as long as the code is lined up the same or a similar way, right? It's the lining up of the code that separates wheat from chaff, experts from juniors, startup from idea and things like that, right? Is getting the code to line up in the right way. But some of the most amazing pieces of technology that I interact with on a daily basis, I recognize are code lined up in a way that is such a great, easy experience that I'm like, wow, this was awesome, right? But getting to that level usually required a lot of skill and a lot of experience. You can spend a week with AI and become pretty proficient at what you're doing. And agentic ties into this, and other capabilities that organizations have, where the speed to get up to a relative, you know, let me rephrase it. The speed to get out of novice is a lot faster than it was in other cases. And there's so many resources out there about how to use it correctly and how to do this and how to do that. And for some reason, you know, how to program in a certain language was always out there and available as well. It just took a while to figure out how to get there. But leveling up with AI, it's like, hey, here's a quick, you know, 45-minute crash course. Do this thing. Watch these two videos. Write some carefully crafted prompts. And boom, you're in the middle of the pack. As opposed to, You could spend 6 months doing a thing and you're still at novice level. And that's the expectation. And
yeah,
I think that just widens the scope, and it also widens an adoption rate, which can cause its own inherent concerns too. And that's another topic maybe for another day.
Because nobody's thinking about security at all.
They are, but like too late as usual, right? Security's getting the second thing. I was actually talking with a buddy last night who was just remarking on, I should say, like AI fueled DLP or DLP that's tapping into what's happening from an AI perspective. There's probably a growth or an industry out there that's doing this, but literally someone was like, hey, you know, how do we know that someone's not uploading sensitive data to a known LLM or right to, to a platform? How do we keep that stuff internal? And right now it was, what telemetry exists for that? How would you even know that someone did that thing, even with the best guidance in place? Mm-hmm. You know, and if you think back to years when it was like, you know, Dropbox came about and Box.com and OneDrive and Google Drive and all this kind of stuff, everyone was just throwing everything up in the cloud and just, you know, store it there, right? Yeah. I can access it later. Well, LLMs act the same way, but it's, as usual, someone else's system. So careful, caution about.
Careful out there. All right.
That's right.
Let's get to it. Funny enough, the first article is on AI. This one's coming to us from Google's Threat Intelligence Group, or GTIG, and they have observed a significant shift in 2025. Threat actors are no longer just using AI to speed up operations. They are now integrating large language models directly into the malware. This evolution includes malware families like Prompt Flux and Prompt Steal, which query LLMs mid-execution to dynamically alter behavior, obfuscate code, and generate system commands on demand. Prompt Flux, for example, uses the Gemini API to regenerate and re-obfuscate its own source code hourly, embedding persistent and evasion capabilities. Prompt Steal, attributed to Russian-backed APT-28, uses the Hugging Face API to obtain system reconnaissance and data exfiltration commands in real time, executing them silently on infected machines. This new phase of AI misuse is marked by what GTIG refers to as just-in-time malware. Threats that rely on generative AI for runtime decisions rather than static logic. Malware such as PromptLock, written in Go, leverages LLMs to dynamically generate Lua scripts for tasks like encryption and file system surveillance. While some of these families are still experimental, the presence of active components like PromptSteel's document collection capabilities indicates this is more than just theoretical. GTIG has confirmed multiple variants in the wild, and Google has disabled associated infrastructure. So yeah, man, I think we're just a few years away from the clone wars here.
I mean, we are certainly in the self-thinking, self-propagating malware capability, I guess, where, you know, back to our earlier discussion about, I guess, prompt engineering and moving out of novice level is look at how adversaries are using LLMs and AI from a threat actor perspective. You know, it's not what everyone thought it would be. It's not... you know, writing AI to craft some sort of unbreakable encryption or something. It's literally deploying a piece of malware and then using a built-in prompt to craft commands custom to the environment in which it's in. So it's true dynamic malware in every sense of the word, Chris, which, you know, I mean, talking about agentic, right? Here we go, right? We're back in this scene now where we've got a tool that can greatly benefit defenders if used in the right way, but can also greatly benefit attackers if used in the wrong way, which we see here. A really, really interesting list of different pieces of malware here. I thought that Fruit Shell, Prompt Flux, Prompt Lock, Prompt Steal, Quiet Vault, some ones that you mentioned, utilizing Hugging Face APIs. These are well-known, well-documented open source APIs that everyone can connect to if they need to. Hugging Face is a free LLM kind of test slash development platform. You can write your own chatbots in there. I've actually used Hugging Face for detection engineering classes before and stuff like that. But in this case right here, right, you know, I'm looking at Prompt Flux, right, prompting the LLM to rewrite its own source code, saving an obfuscated version to the startup folder. I mean, Chris, we've talked before about, you know, evading defenses and getting around the best laid plans and security implementations and whatnot. And imagine you've got this kind of workflow, a piece of malware gets dropped on a system. That's success number one. The malware kind of assesses the environment that it's in, beams all this up in a prompt, writes a custom script based on what it's seeing, and then goes and does kind of the rest of its mission or whatever is left after that. And just at the end of the day, if you craft the prompt correctly, you could end up with some really dynamic things that make it hard to detect. And we end up spending more time looking for the AI implementation, the LLM implementation, as opposed to like the actual piece of malware itself. So
yeah,
lots of interesting techniques being used here at play. Really great article from the folks over at Google. I highly recommend, you know, everyone checking this out. The adversarial lifecycle diagram that they have is just absolutely lengthy. I mean, it's getting into all sorts of LLM abuse, how misuse of Gemini has been used at nearly every stage of the attack lifecycle. I mean, it's a new world out there for sure.
Yeah. So another concerning trend is how threat actors are increasing social engineering themselves to bypass safety guardrails. Google's Gemini has been targeted with deceptive prompts from actors pretending to be students in a capture the flag competition or academic researchers. These actors reframe their requests to gain access to restricted information, such as vulnerability exploitation techniques or web shell development. In several cases, the prompts triggered Gemini's safety responses, but persistent actors were able to elicit responses by adopting seemingly benign personas. For instance, China Nexus actors use CTF scenarios to craft more convincing prompts, ultimately helping them build out phishing and exploitation infrastructure. Attribution across the threat landscape shows state-aligned groups from North Korea, Iran, and China adopting AI tooling to augment full-spectrum operations. North Korea's UNC1069 used Gemini for cryptocurrency theft operations, including researching wallet data locations and generating social engineering content in Spanish to widen its targets. Iran's APT42 misused Gemini to create phishing emails, translate targeted content, and even attempted to build a data processing agent capable of executing SQL queries to extract personal information. Temp.Zagros, another Iranian group, revealed sensitive infrastructure details during an AI-assisted coding session, leading to operational disruption by GTIG. The cybercrime marketplace has also matured with illicit AI services mirroring SaaS business models, offering tiered pricing, subscription access, and functionality like deepfake generation, phishing kit development, and code generation. These services lower the barrier to entry, making complex operations more accessible to technically unsophisticated actors. AI-generated lure content, vulnerability research assistance, and language translation are all being offered to support phishing, exploitation, and C2 development. GTIG emphasizes that while most of the more novel use cases are still in development, the transition from passive AI-assisted workflows to active AI-integrated malware marks a structural shift in threat actor capabilities that defenders must now adopt to. So just like, you know, writing legit software or making a startup, AI helps you bridge the gap and get into the game quicker. It's also doing the same thing for threat actors.
Absolutely. I mean, why should they be excluded from all the benefits? Come on now. No, in a very realistic sense, this is another situation where, like I said earlier, you know, there's a great tool and a great technological capability that's out there. Didn't take long for adversaries to harness it for their own malicious intent. And unfortunately, that's just what we're seeing now. That's where we're at now is, the use of kind of embedded LLM calls, all sorts of, and there are a couple of additional looks here, vulnerability exploitation, phishing, malware development. I mean, I think, Chris, we're going to continue to see this happen for quite a while. The ways that adversaries are misusing AI is going to probably put a little bit of a hamper on adoption of AI. And I guess where I'm, you know, not to say that anyone's going to say, oh, well, the attackers are doing it, so we're not going to do it, right? But I think it exposes just how quickly it can be integrated into an attack path.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not pointing any fingers at any AI providers. I mean, Hugging Face offering an LLM API is, you know, great for the industry, and it does a lot to forward development nooses and stuff like that. But it just goes to show how quickly adversaries can weaponize this. And I think that we will hopefully start to see, maybe some better controls at a enterprise level, but also at an AI level. From a provider level, for lack of a better term. And similar to what we see with other tools, there's always going to be a gray area. And we're just going to have to kind of exist in that gray area from a security perspective. You know, I think of Microsoft tooling or like sysinternals tooling in that exact same category, Chris, of like it's inherently good software that is designed for use by sysadmins, but adversaries can misuse it. And it doesn't mean we don't use the thing. It means we wrap controls and detections around them, and we understand what it looks like in our environment. Is it good? Is it bad? And then that's kind of what we use to profile going forward. But we can't say, oh, this thing is horrible because it's being misused, right? As opposed to like straight up malware, which just block it. But in this case, we've got to be careful and watch out where the usage is in your environment.
And I think it's going to, I mean, we say this over and over, but I think it's going to get much worse. I was just talking to a guy named Michael Baker, who's the CISO at DXC Technology, which is like this massive company. And he was telling me about some of the startups they're talking to who are doing AI-driven red teaming and AI zero-day finding. And the latter one is having a ton of success finding 0 days. And it's, you know, those are startups on the blue side of the house. But like, you think of what APT's funding this kind of stuff in other countries are going to be building, right? It's
I mean, we'll see. I don't know. I don't know if I see this capability going away. I think it's too easy for the threat actors now. I think we'll continue to see unique implementations of this. But just looking at some of the ways that they're integrating it, I mean, I know Google has gone through this, shutting down various abuses against Gemini and stuff. But the thing is, like, the idea of an adversary reaching out to an LLM is not limited to your commercial providers. Sure, it's not like Anthropic, OpenAI, Google can just shut it down, right? They could utilize their own hosted LLMs. They can utilize open APIs if they wanted to. I mean, it's going to continue to be an issue. So I'm glad to hear that, like, you know, the big kids on the block are taking steps to minimize it, but it's the problem is not going to go away at all.
All right. Well, let's get back to some more traditional malware here. Unit 42 has identified a previously undocumented Android spyware family named Landfall, discovered during an investigation into iOS exploit chains involving malicious DNG images. Landfall targeted Samsung Galaxy devices by exploiting a zero-day vulnerability tracked as CVE-2025-21042 in Samsung's one of their libraries. This vulnerability allowed attackers to deliver spyware embedded in malformed DNG image files, often disguised as WhatsApp media. The campaign was active as early as mid-2024, well before Samsung issued a patch in April 2025. While Landfall is no longer an active threat due to the patch, its discovery offers insight into a stealthy, commercially developed surveillance campaign. The exploit chain likely enabled zero-click remote code execution when victims simply received a malicious image via WhatsApp. The DNG files contained an appended zip archive from which two primary components of Landfall were extracted. This provided attackers full surveillance capabilities, audio recording, file access, system reconnaissance, WhatsApp monitoring, and elevated privileges via manipulated SE Linux policy. Targeted devices included Samsung Galaxy S22 and S24 models and foldables like the Z Flip 4 and Z Fold 4. Yeah, mobile's a thing.
Interesting here. Zero click remote code execution when victims simply received a malicious image file via WhatsApp. I found this one to be pretty interesting, actually. And there's a very, very lengthy review here. So hats off to the team at Unit 42. It's a predictable 21-minute read, which is huge from a blog post perspective. But looking to see how it kind of works out, Chris, digging through some of the technical capabilities of here. Of course, I think we've talked about this on a previous, or I should say a recent episode as well, associated with known spyware groups and things like that. They identified some spyware components that refer to itself as Bridgehead, which is a nickname used by some private offensive cybersecurity companies, ones that we've talked about before as well. Those kind of, you know, folks that sell this type of software that can be purchased by governments and organizations and whatnot. But there's a really interesting breakdown of how the kind of malware does what it does, how the C2 communication works, what some of the capabilities are. And I found all of these just really fascinating to read through, not because malware in itself is fascinating, but really well built out kind of execution chain. And then the really big kicker here is the CVEs that it takes advantage of. There is a CVE in Apple. Admittedly, Unit 42 comes back and says, we can't confirm whether there is a, you know, equivalent of Landfall to iOS. But they do address Apple's CVE 2025-43-300. You might talk about this in a little bit, but this is related to an August 2025 vulnerability. But in particular, they walk through the timeline of how it was reported to Samsung. And I view this as a kind of a catch-22 here. You're going after folks, and it looks like the, you know, usage of WhatsApp is kind of critical here. It needs to be, you know, it needs to be included. And in that itself, you're kind of addressing different global or geographic or regional markets there. It does mention in the blog post, potential targets in Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Morocco. And just having traveled out in that part of the world and seen it before, WhatsApp is highly used in, I'm going to say EMEA, I think maybe as the best term, minus the A. So EME, right? European, what? Middle Eastern nations love using WhatsApp, common communication vector out there. And for that reason, I think that kind of speaks to, you know, what the target groups may have been and how this worked out. But I know you've got a little bit more into the insight, but just found this to be a great blog post. Admittedly, my day-to-day, and I think your today as well, we don't do much from a mobile malware perspective, but it is always a really interesting component to read about how they target different devices and different models. And actually in the malware itself, they actually have the model numbers for the Galaxy S23, 24, and some others called out directly, which just leads into more insight of, you know, just how targeted and how direct the authors intended to be here.
And correct me if I'm wrong, though, isn't this like the third WhatsApp zero click vulnerability in the last 12 to 14 months? I feel like we've seen this quite a bit. Yeah,
we've talked about WhatsApp quite a bit here. I think it shows up it's shown up in a few different episodes of ours, just because it is, I think, within that pool of commonly targeted groups in certain parts of the world, as well as being a mobile messaging platform.
Yeah.
And I think it's always going to show up, not always, but it's going to be a repeat offender, I guess, if you will, because of who they're going after,
right,
and the security behind it. And no offense to anyone at WhatsApp, right? But it's very rare we talk about iMessage.
Yep.
It's very rare we talk about iMessage, right? We talk more, I think, on this podcast about WhatsApp and Telegram. WhatsApp being a target, Telegram being a vehicle. And I think this all just lends to either victim hierarchy or victim infrastructure versus maybe attacker infrastructure, where the attackers like to talk versus where they like to attack, and then vice versa.
Okay, well, no specific private sector offensive actor has been formally attributed. Multiple indicators suggest Landfall is commercial grade spyware. Its modular architecture, debug artifacts, and naming conventions align with known spyware frameworks like Heliconica associated with vendors such as Veristen. Additionally, Landfall's C2 infrastructure overlaps with Stealth Falcon's infrastructure, a threat group linked to the UAE. Although there's no direct operational linkage yet between Landfall and known Stealth Falcon campaigns, virus total telemetry indicated possible victim geographies, including Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Morocco, with Turkey's national CERT tagging Landfall's C2 IPs as related to APT activity. Landfall showcases advanced capabilities in evasion, persistence, and remote control with encrypted C2 communications, dynamic module loading, both .so and DEX, and mechanisms for maintaining stealth, including anti-debugging and detection of instrumentation frameworks like Frida and Exposed. The B.so components contain hard-coded configuration values and encrypted JSON-based C2 parameters, supporting remote command execution, data exfiltration, and further payload deployment. Palo Alto Networks has updated protections across wildfire, advanced threat protection, URL filtering, and DNS security to detect Landfall-related activity, and they're actively sharing IOCs with CTA partners. So yeah, I mean, I find this super interesting just because of how vulnerable or like how critical mobile devices and the kind of information that threat actors can pull off of that. So
yeah, and also, of course, the ubiquity of them as well, right? I mean, your laptop, your software versions might change, the libraries you use might change, but everyone's got their mobile on them. And if WhatsApp is one of your primary communication mechanisms, you're likely going to be clicking stuff and opening things out. And this one's a zero click. So watch out, folks. Watch out, especially in those parts of the world.
I watched one of the old Terminator movies the other day, and Linda Hamilton is carrying around her phone in an aluminum chip bag. And I think I might start doing that as well.
Everyone gets a portable Faraday for Christmas.
That's right. Okay, next up, Microsoft's November Patch Tuesday rollout includes fixes for over 60 vulnerabilities, one of which is a zero-day privilege escalation flaw in the Windows kernel, tracked as CVE-2025-62215, that has already been exploited in the wild. Microsoft rates it as important severity, but its exploitation potential is significant. It allows attackers to elevate privileges to system-level access. The exploit relies on winning a race condition, though Microsoft does not publish details about the act of exploitation or threat actor attribution. The vulnerability was discovered internally by the Microsoft Threat Intelligence Center and the Microsoft Security Response Center. In addition, Microsoft patched 4 critical security bugs this month. These affected Windows Office, Visual Studio, and Nuance PowerScribe 360, a clinical documentation solution used in healthcare environments. While specifics about the critical vulnerabilities weren't detailed in this summary, the typical impact from this class of flaws includes remote code execution or elevation privilege. So, Matt, I put this one in there just because I wanted you to say
patch.
There you go.
Yeah. No, Chris, when I read through this, I had a really interesting logical, like, double check, if you will, on this one. So the 62215 that you had talked about, the kernel elevation of privilege vulnerability. Wah, had to think that one out. CVSS score of 7, which isn't the highest we've talked about on this podcast. It appears to impact Windows 10 and above, I believe. So, and I think that's most of the landscape these days, but the impacted products range from Windows 10 all the way to Server 2025. You talked about it earlier being a race condition, but I think what I found more interesting, Chris, especially in the way that you kind of delivered that there was, I'm looking through some of this here, the attack complexity is very high. The privileges required are very low. And the confidentiality, integrity, availability, the CIA triad and whatnot, high as well from a Microsoft perspective. So definitely some interesting score metrics in there. But the exploit code maturity, there is functional exploit code available, 1. And 2, as you mentioned, it's been exploited in the wild. Mm-hmm. Successful exploitation of this vulnerability requires an attacker to win a race condition. And I believe you were mentioning that it has been detected in the wild, 1. Yeah. And 2, it was found by the Microsoft Research Center.
Well, that's confusing, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That's the part where it's kind of like, okay, they found a vulnerability. I totally understand that part. But then they had the ability to somehow say, oh, yeah, this is being exploited in the wild. And I want to understand.
Maybe they took a
gap.
Look at the logs. There were some IOCs that they were able to capture. That
whose IOCs?
Well, it's Microsoft. It's everybody's IOCs, isn't it?
Whose IOCs? Where has this thing been exploited before? That's what I want to know. Imagine if you showed up to a trade show and you were like, hey, check out this brand new product I've got. People love using it. And you're like, who? And you're like, I can't tell you who, but people love it. And you'd be like, well, how do you know people love it? You know? And then let's add a little further, Chris. Let's say I said to you, hey, I've got this spy camera that if you install it in your house, it is completely untraceable, completely untrackable. No one knows about it until you go retrieve it yourself. By the way, my customers love the 4K video that's on it. Here's a sample. And you're kind of like, wait a second. I thought it was untraceable, untrackable. How do you know about it? Right? And getting into the silly world of vulnerability disclosures here, I'm glad that it's being disclosed and it's being talked about. But I have such curiosity about that gap, which makes me think there might be an incident somewhere that maybe that team investigated that was, you know, a little bit of a light bulb, and then the team actually found it, like the research team. But maybe it's one of those situations where it's kind of like, it's been found because it was exploited, but we're not going to give that threat actor credit, which I'm okay with.
All right. So beyond the critical and zero-day fixes, this update batch includes dozens of other patches across a wide swath of Microsoft's ecosystems. Patches were issued for Azure Monitor Agent, Microsoft Configuration Manager, Dynamics 365, SharePoint Office, OneDrive, Visual Studio, and Edge. Microsoft noted that over 30 vulnerabilities this month are privilege escalation flaws, a class of vulnerability that has been a favorite among threat actors for post-exploitation lateral movement or sandbox escape. A total of 22 remote code execution vulnerabilities were also patched, along with other classes such as spoofing, denial of service, security feature bypass, and information disclosure bugs. Given the diversity of affected components, organizations should ensure broad coverage in
patching
deployment across both endpoint and service infrastructure. Full details on the vulnerabilities are available through Microsoft's MSRC portal, which includes individual CVE entries and the respective mitigation notes. So yeah, I mean, Patch Tuesday is a thing that happens all the time, but this one caught my attention, and yeah, I just wanted to hear you say the thing.
Quick little sidebar for everyone who may or may not be aware, every second Tuesday of the month is Patch Tuesday. That's where Chris is pulling that one from. So if you run or are in charge of a Microsoft infrastructure and you don't yet know about that, number one, welcome to the year 2010. Number two, Tuesday, the second Tuesday of every month, build that into your patching schedule, build it into your assessment and start to prepare for it because you know it's coming.
And there's always a shocking number of things being patched. Like it's a,
some of them, some of them I understand, right? If I look at the release guide here, I mean, some of these are, you know, basic, I mean, CVSS scores, and I'm swinging low here, right?
Yeah.
Some of them are, you know, 4.3s and whatnot. There is a 9.8 that was called out in there, which is part of the Microsoft graphics component, a remote code execution, heap-based buffer overflow, but the likelihood is very, very low. So, you know, really what you want to zoom in on for anyone who's curious about this is, and AI can be a great use case for this, is identifying the things that have maybe exploitation more likely and exploitation detected even, and those are the things that you want to focus on if you need to prioritize. Now, Chris and I have said this before, don't wait until this is in the CISA Kev list. But unfortunately, sometimes, Chris, as we've seen, the Kev list update and the Microsoft update might happen within the same day. So in that case, you know, that should be your final tripwire to patch the things.
All right. The last one is one for the Schadenfreude files. A former executive at L3 Harris Trenchant, Peter Williams, has pleaded guilty in U.S. federal court to selling 8 trade secrets valued at over $1.3 million to a Russian-based software broker involved in the zero-day exploit market. Williams, an Australian national residing in the U.S., faces up to 20 years in prison, 10 years for each of the 2 trade secret theft charges, as well as fines potentially totaling $300,000 based on sentencing guidelines. According to the plea agreement, Williams will also pay restitution of $1.3 million. He is currently under house confinement with electronic monitoring while awaiting sentencing in early 2026. Prosecutors say Williams sold the sensitive material between April 2022 and August 2025, a timeframe that partially overlaps with his tenure at L3 Trenchant, a vendor that developed zero-day exploits and offensive cyber tools for the U.S. and its allies. Before joining Trenchant, Williams worked at the Australian Signals Directorate, or ASD, Australia's equivalent of the NSA. L3 Trenchant itself is a result of the 2018 merger of Azimuth Security and Linchpin Labs, both with deep ties to Five Eyes intelligence operations. So I got to say, this one, I'm like, good. I hope he gets the full thing. You know, you're in a position of trust with that kind of information. You know, we're talking about like national security stuff here. So, yeah.
Yeah, this one hits close to home for you and me, part of the Five Eyes. This one, you know, taps into the intelligence apparatus that overlooks our homelands, if you will. And that's the most patriotic sentence I've ever said on this podcast. But with that said, you know, Chris, I'm kind of there with you. I don't really have anything to add other than like throw the book at this guy. Yeah. Right. Some of these private contractors, some of these companies, they are developing, you know, or doing research into really highly privileged spaces, zero day vulnerabilities, exploitation development, obviously for the purposes of a military apparatus to use. Right. Let's not skirt around that part. But that being said, you know, it doesn't give you the right to sell state secrets to anyone else. And I'm being careful with the word state secrets here, not because this is privilege or privy just to the country that's paying for the development, but because it does fall under a national security category. And if you're going to do this kind of stuff, be aware of what you're selling and what the restitutions are and what the repercussions are, and then don't do it. Because it's not worth it, right? It's not worth it to go down that road and do these particular things. As you mentioned, there are definitely a ton of records behind this. This individual, Peter Williams here, definitely was in a very, very privileged space, has sat in some very high positions across different Five Eyes, as you called out. I believe was at the ASD in the 2010s. There was, you know, all sorts of hacking and signals intelligence work and stuff that went on. And, you know, it's just when you're in this privileged space like this, Chris, from a, and I say this, you know, with a lot of love and care for this industry, unfortunately, the lines become very thin for some folks, and it's tough to stay on one side of it. And I'm not justifying what Williams did in any situation whatsoever here, but I'm trying to maybe a call out for folks who have sat in this space. You know, sometimes pressing enter on a keyboard can actually launch an attack that does a particular thing. And if you disagree, there's other ways to go about it instead of selling off to the enemy and whatnot. And, you know, in this case right here, I think there was probably a moment where Peter was like, yes, you know, I got paid. I got my money. Right. And then history catches up and all of a sudden it's like, oh no, I wish I didn't do any of that. But as a detractor to anyone else who's out there, don't get involved in this kind of stuff. It's just not worth it.
What baffles me too is to, like, you know, have this kind of inside knowledge and know how all of the espionage and monitoring and everything works, and to still be arrogant enough to think you can get away with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, that's the, that's how it works, right? What was the individual who worked inside of the CIA, the Robert Hansen, I think it's right. Usually I don't mean this in any positive way, but usually the best traders are the ones who are the closest to the action, because they are able to make an assessment and say, oh, what is this thing actually doing? What's this? What's that? You know, I'm not justifying it in by any means, but I'm assuming that there are some folks around the globe working for all sorts of military or intelligence or signals apparatuses who see their malware in action and probably don't necessarily always feel good about the outcome, right? Chris, I'm thinking about that one ransomware case that was at a hospital that I think ended up shutting down, you know, shutting maybe systems offline. And I think it like delayed a surgery and a patient died or something like that. I mean, it was, you know, daisy chained at best. It wasn't like the ransomware reached through the wire and shut off this guy's pacemaker or something. But in a situation like that, you write a piece of code and a piece of software and you're doing it at the direction of whatever. And then the next thing you know, that code runs, it does this, it does that. And four or five steps later, you see some kinetic outcome and you're just like, that's not supposed to happen.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't supposed to get there. And I think that can swing some people in different directions. There was a report I read once about how comparing like people who had kind of grown up on video games. And this isn't, it's a little bit related. So let me get to the end of it. But comparing folks who had kind of been raised on things like Call of Duty and whatnot, you just always spawn and start over again. Right. And then you take those folks and you put them kind of on like a real battlefield and they have a mental sense of what they think it is and stuff like that. But it's like once it gets kinetic and you can hear the, you know, bullet sizzling by, you realize, oh, hold on, this is real. All right. And in a similar case, if you're someone who's writing malware and you're getting paid to exploit stuff and you're just kind of, you know, in the bleeding edge ear depth in the greatest and latest of what's happening from an exploit perspective. And then the next thing you know, someone comes along, it's like, hey, I can offer you a little bit of side cash for that thing. And you're like, you know, screw it. Let's go. Let's sell it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really sink in from a real world perspective because you think it's just malware.
Yeah.
You know, you think it's just software at this point. Like, it's a little bit of code that I wrote. And
you don't
maybe
see
someone
what happens at the end of that.
They don't understand their mission or they don't understand what's at the end of it. And I drew that tangential example in there because it's really easy to get lost in the minutia of what you're doing and not think about the real world implications. And then when it hits you from a real world perspective, you're like, oh, wow. I didn't realize I was doing that. You know, I equate this. You know, and I'll finish after this example here, but I equate this to folks who write kind of like that, you know, those spyware pieces of malware, those organizations we've talked about it many times. We actually talked about one a couple articles ago. Those folks who write those pieces of software that are really good at exploiting text messages or zero click exploitation on cell phones and stuff. And you're there writing this code and you're like, wow, look at this awesome thing that I created. It had, you know, severely advanced technical capabilities. And then 6 months later, you learn, oh yeah, some government utilized that piece of software to fine and hang 10 dissidents or something. And you're like, whoa, that's not what was supposed to happen. You know, it hits you hard. And some folks find that line very difficult to sit on. And I'm not justifying Williams whatsoever. I'm trying to detract folks around the world who are maybe sitting on that line or in those positions to don't do this type of stuff. You don't swing to the other side, right? Find other ways to get out of it if you need to, but don't get in a situation where you're selling to the enemy.
Yeah. So the buyer of the trade secrets is reportedly a Russian-based zero-day broker, unnamed in court, but described by prosecutors as purchasing exploits from researchers and reselling them to non-NATO countries. One social media post from the company in September 2023 advertised payouts of up to $20 million for mobile exploits, language identical to a post from Operation Zero, a self-described zero-day marketplace in Russia. Prosecutors say Williams used the alias John Taylor and an encrypted email to conduct the deals and in some cases signed contracts that included post-sale support. Notably, Williams had direct involvement in an internal investigation into a separate leak of L3 trenchant tooling in 2024, an investigation he oversaw as general manager. He was voluntarily interviewed by the FBI multiple times in 2025, even describing how a hypothetical insider might exfiltrate software from secured environments. Just weeks later, prosecutors say he signed contracts with the Russian buyer under his alias. By August, confronted by the FBI, Williams admitted to the sales. The Justice Department is now moving to seize his assets, including bank accounts, cryptocurrency wallets, and a Washington, D.C. home allegedly purchased with proceeds from the crime. L3 Trenchant itself is not facing criminal liability, but the incident underscores the risk of insider threats and commercial exploit development operations. The stolen material reportedly included source code and other software artifacts, though the two companies impacted have not been named. The broader context of this case adds to concerns around zero-day commoditization, as well as the cross-border movement of offensive cyber capabilities, particularly from Five Eyes-aligned vendors to adversarial markets. That last sentence kind of reminded me, how many years ago is it now that all those tools got leaked?
The shadow brokers and everything like that?
Yeah, yeah. All the insider
about
tools.
Maybe 10 years or so?
Is it that long now? Oh,
man. I'm trying to remember when that when that happened.
Because that leveled the playing field pretty
the
quick.
The summer of 2016.
Oh, wow. 10
so
years.
Almost 10 years.
Oh, my God.
Almost there. Yeah, wild, wild time. Yeah. Chris, I wanted to add on in our third article of the day today, we talked about a Microsoft Patch Tuesday. And sure enough, the CVE that we talked about, it is in the Kev list. So there we go. All the wires have been tripped for anyone who's wondering, should I patch now? But
do the thing.
That's right.
All right, sir. Thanks for doing it again with me this week. It's such a part of my week now. I couldn't imagine doing it without you.
Likewise. It's always fun, and I'll see you again in 6 to 7 days.
All right. Take care, sir.
Thanks, Chris. See ya.
Bye.
And that brings us to the end of another Intel Chat. You can support this show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend or subscribing and giving us a rating or leaving a comment on your chosen podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation and access the intel we talk about in real time, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.